Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, August 29, 2017. The body of a U.S. freelance journalist killed by South Sudan forces is turned over to U.S. embassy officials in Juba.
Unfortunately, I cannot say much due to privacy considerations for the family. We thank the military and the MFA for releasing the body to us today.
And citizens of the Sudan worry about a U.S. program for immigrants.
The administration decides to not extend TPS for some of these people who have been here for decades. Decades under this, and there's no way for them to be able to get a green card or to get citizenship. So they're stuck in this status until something else happens.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The South Sudan Army handed over the body of an American freelance journalist to U.S. embassy officials in Juba today. The government forces killed Christopher Allen on Saturday while he was embedded with rebel fighters near the South Sudan-Uganda border. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
South Sudan government officials turned over the body of 28-year-old journalist Christopher Allen to U.S. embassy officials at the Juba Military Hospital. Dennis Knapp is the consul at the U.S. Embassy in South Sudan.
Unfortunately, I cannot say much due to privacy considerations for the family. We thank the military and the MFA for releasing the body to us today.
Government spokesman Michael McQuay told the VOA on Monday that the white man was fighting alongside the rebels. SPLA in opposition, deputy spokesman Colonel Lampaul Gabriel told the VOA Allen was only armed with a camera to photograph the battle between government and rebel forces in Kaya when he was shot. The U.S. Embassy confirmed Allen was an American freelance journalist. South Sudan military spokesman Brigadier General Lul Roy Kwang says Allen's body was not released until today because of ongoing investigations into what happened on Saturday.
We wanted to know his profession, nationality, and his identity in terms of his names. That one we had been unable to know until when a note babal was written to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation.
Knapp says Allen was reporting in war zone areas in several countries across the world. Dr. Peter Ajagabulen, the director of the SPLA Military Corps, says a postmortem he conducted confirmed that Allen died from a gunshot wound to the head.
When we received the body, he had a bullet in his head, a huge one. Of course, the exit is always big. The entry is small. It entered from the left, came out on the right.
Human Rights Watch and other international rights groups have condemned Allen's killing, saying it violates international humanitarian law and should be investigated. Allen and two other journalists were embedded with the rebels during a two-week mission along the South Sudan-Uganda border, and they had arrived from Kampala, according to Colonel Gabriel. Allen is the 10th journalist to be killed in South Sudan since the country gained independence in 2011. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Thousands of Sudanese and South Sudanese nationals live in the United States under the temporary protected status. It is a period of time the U.S. Attorney General may provide to immigrants who temporarily cannot safely return to their country of origin because of ongoing conflict, environmental disaster, or other extraordinary conditions. SIN Bureau reports, advocates worry the Trump administration may restrict or terminate the program for people from Sudan and South Sudan.
In less than a week, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security is expected to make a decision on the temporary protected status for people from Sudan and South Sudan. By September 3rd, the government is expected to announce whether it will extend, redesignate, or terminate the program for the two countries. Patrice Lawrence is an advocate for immigrants with the organization called UndocuBlack.
If the administration decides to not extend TPS for some of these people who have been here for decades, decades under this, and there's no way for them to be able to get a green card or to get citizenship. So they're stuck in this status until something else happens.
Sharon Scheidhauer, a public affairs officer at the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, said in an email that at least 2 months before the expiration date, Homeland Security will review conditions in both countries and determine whether an extension, redesignation, or termination is warranted. So far, no announcements have been made public. Under the worst-case scenario, terminating the program, Lawrence says, hundreds of Sudanese and South Sudanese will be forced to make an impossible decision as the conflict in South Sudan continues.
There's no guarantee that after September, when that decision is made, and then in November, if that expires, that they can stay here with any form of protection, that they will be able to legally have any form of work and be able to provide for their families. And it's really like a rock and a hard place. Where do you go? What do you do? Because you go back to a country that all your family is here and you've lost so many things. What do you do? It's an impossible dilemma.
The TPS designation is crucial for thousands of immigrants living in the United States who are allowed to legally work here and travel in and out of the U.S. Once granted TPS, an individual cannot be detained by the Department of Homeland Security on the basis of his or her immigration status in the United States. Somalia is the only other African country with a TPS designation outside of Sudan and South Sudan. In May, Haiti was granted a six-month extension, which is a break from the 18-month extension Haitian immigrants under TPS in the U.S. have enjoyed in the past. Graysa Rosas is an undocumented immigrant and an advocate for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. DACA is similar to TPS in that it is both temporary and does not provide a path to citizenship for immigrants. Rosas has spent her years advocating for DACA, but says she is also in solidarity with people under TPS. She says, given the current political climate in the United States and President Trump's past disparaging remarks about immigrants, a dark cloud hangs over hundreds of thousands of immigrants who rely on programs like DACA and TPS to live and work legally in the U.S.
Moving forward, I will always be unafraid in the face of things, but that right now it's a difficult moment, and I wanted to acknowledge that for people. But that, you know, I think that there's, it's important to know that, like, we are continued and are ready to continue to fight and ready to continue to put our faces and our bodies on the line to protect our democracy.
Becky Belcour, who works with the North Korean American Service and Education Consortium, agrees.
We're going to continue to fight, and so we will continue to advocate for both of those programs, that they should be restored, but we're also going to be looking for legislative solutions that are more permanent.
Belcour says temporary protected status and deferred action for childhood arrivals are programs that should be more comprehensive so immigrants do not live under constant fear or threat of being deported. Ayan Bior for VOA News, Washington.
Texas Attorney General says Hurricane Harvey is probably the biggest storm in the U.S. southern state's history. 3 days after it hit the coast, the storm rains are unrelenting, transforming streets into rivers. Thousands of residents are stranded in submerged homes, and at least 4 people have died. The National Weather Service calls the flooding unprecedented. South Sudanese native Tabitha Awor, who lives with her family in Houston, says the floods forced her family and neighbors to stay inside. But when one of her neighbors went into labor during the hurricane, the entire community responded to make sure mother and baby were safe.
I'm inside my apartment right now on the second floor, but within that, I live in an apartment complex where there's hundreds of people that live here. And the first day, with the Sunday, we got an email from our apartment that there was a lady about to have a baby on the first floor, and she was getting water inside her apartment. So I remember I went downstairs, and there was a doctor that lives under us, and I was like, did you get the email? And so I remember that being the most, like, oh my goodness, we have to help this lady. But the whole apartment complex, it was a river, but we all were running, trying to go to save, to help this lady with her baby. End up, we had an OB living here because we live by the medical center, thankfully. So a bunch of doctors went there, and this guy that my neighbor, he's a medicine doctor, but he had some things with him, you know, and he ran over there. So I saw them airlift the lady to the hospital, you know. I mean, that's something, National Guards all over around our apartments and people walking outside trying to see what's going on. And we can't walk any farther because there's water around the apartment complex. We can only walk between the apartments. She had the baby and she's fine. We got an email yesterday. The mom and the baby are okay.
That's great to hear. Tabitha, yeah. You yourself are 5 months pregnant. What's it been like for you?
I was super nervous and but I just couldn't sit in my bed and just lay there. I just remember walking outside and just, trying to see what I could do. I'm fine, but I'm just nervous for those women out there that are due today or yesterday. I just don't know. I just think it's nerve-wracking, and when you know you can't go anywhere, the main roads and the hospitals, there's a lot of hospitals that are closed that don't have a helicopter, to land on top. So there's only a few hospitals that are open.
How high has the water gotten for you guys?
Ours is almost 4 feet. I mean, we didn't really get in, but I just remember on the steps, it was super high. It was on the rail.
You have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old son. How are they doing?
My 4-year-old, he's very, I remember explaining to him Saturday night, I was like, we might not have water. We might not have power or water the next day. So let's fill up this tub. Saturday night, we filled up the tub. And then the next morning, Sunday morning, he woke me up. He's like, Mommy, there's water on the cars. And I'm like, no. And I went out and there was water there. So he was he's very anxious about what's going on, but it's scary. It's scary at the same time. But my 2-year-old, he does not understand. We went outside and he wanted to be Carrie the whole time because he's just nervous. That's never seen anything like that. And we have a pond and a swimming pool in the middle of our complex. You can't tell the difference. Everything is even up. So if you don't live there and you could just walk into the pond.
How did you prepare for such an enormous storm?
Well, Thursday, we got gas. We shop. We prepare a lot. One thing that we did, we have a garage. We parked both of our cars in the garage, thankfully. So now we have 2 cars that are good, but everyone in our apartment, there's half of the people here, their cars are destroyed. They can't drive them.
Tabitha, did you and your family lose any services?
Yeah, we didn't have TV. We didn't have internet and TV on Sunday, which that was the worst day, because we didn't know what was going on. And so but we just got our internet and TV back yesterday, yesterday. So now we are able to see what's going on around us. And the phones were very slow because everyone else is using, their service and no internet.
Have the rain stopped? Has the flood subsided?
No, it's been raining. It's been raining since Friday. The rain is not stopping. Yesterday, it's windy right now. It's windy and raining. But right now, the problem is the rivers are overflowing. So so that's the scariest part.
Well, Tabitha, I wish you and your family the best of luck. And I'm glad to hear that you guys are safe.
Thank you. Thank you. And still, I just want everyone to pray for Houston. It's not, we're fine, but there's people out there right now that are stuck inside their attics, waiting for help. Those are the people. And, it's a nightmare.
That was Tabitha Awor, a Houston resident and a native of South Sudan, speaking to Ayen Bier from her apartment in Houston, Texas. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, people who survive Ebola may still face many serious health challenges. Find out when we come back.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
if you were given a small plot of land to farm, what would you plant? Why?
Beans is a crop that within 6 months, it will mature for harvesting. And there is a shortage of food. So we need something that will come to the market to feed people or to feed my family.
I'll plant vegetables because vegetables carry a lot of vitamins and they're very essential for the body.
Every other plant has a market, but passion fruits, they have a demand because there's so many people around the city do passion juice and all those things.
With groundnuts, it's something that you can make so many things through groundnut. You can make money, you can get groundnut oil, so many things.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's time for our Tuesday Health segment. And today we are discussing post-Ebola issues. Those who are fortunate enough to survive infection with the Ebola virus could still face multiple health problems. New research says 80% of Ebola survivors suffer disabilities 1 year after being discharged from the hospital. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The 2014 to 2016 West Africa Ebola outbreak killed about 11,000 people, but tens of thousands who were infected survived. However, that does not mean their lives returned to normal. In fact, for many, it was just the opposite. Dr. Janet Scott is a clinical lecturer of pharmacology and infectious disease at the University of Liverpool and one of the senior authors of the study. Researchers at the university and the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine are studying what's called post-Ebola syndrome.
Once a patient is discharged from the treatment center, they have survived, but that's not quite the end of it. We found that quite a lot of our patients were coming back with various sorts of aches and pains and problems.
These included headaches that lasted for months and vision problems. Researchers surveyed the patients a few weeks after they were discharged and began recording Ebola's after effects. But why are survivors experiencing such disabilities?
That's a really good question, and I'm not sure we've quite got to the bottom of it yet. The idea that you go through something as horrific as Ebola and you just walk away from that unscathed was always a bit of a vain hope. So it could be the inflammatory response, it could be damage to the muscle, it could be the persistence of virus in some cases. It could be all of those things.
Scott says problems found in Ebola survivors' eyes may provide a clue as to what's happening elsewhere in the body.
They show some quite distinct scarring patterns. So there's definitely scar tissue there. We can see it in the eyes. We can't see it in the rest of the body, but I'm sure it's in the rest of the body because the patients are coming in with this huge range of problems. So there was definitely something going on.
These disabilities were reported in past Ebola outbreaks as well, but they were very small compared to the West Africa outbreak, and there were few survivors. So researchers were not able to do any major long-term study on the after effects.
There are 5,000 survivors, there thereabouts, in Sierra Leone alone and more in Guinea and Liberia. So it's an opportunity from a research point of view to find out the full spectrum of sequelae. Sequelae are the things that happen after an acute illness.
Military Hospital 34 in Freetown, Sierra Leone, also took part in the study, helping to recruit 27 Ebola virus disease survivors and 54 close contacts who were not infected. About 80% of survivors reported disabilities, compared to just 11% of close contacts.
The problems we're seeing in the Ebola survivors, this is not due just to the tough life in Sierra Leone. This is more than likely down to their experience in Ebola.
Dr. Scott hopes the findings can be used to provide better care in the event of another Ebola outbreak, no matter where it is. She says in the West Africa outbreak, the first goal was to contain the epidemic, followed by reducing the death rate.
If I was treating an Ebola patient, again, it has to be more than just surviving. We have to try to make people survive well. Surviving with half your body paralyzed or with your vision impaired and being unable to care for your family or earn a living isn't really enough. So what I would like to do is to focus on that aspect to make people survive better and to survive well.
The research in which Dr. Scott took part was led by Dr. Sushieta Jagadesh of the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. She says that a year following acute disease, survivors of West Africa Ebola virus disease continue to have a higher chance of disability in mobility, cognition, and vision. She adds that issues such as anxiety and depression persist in survivors and must not be neglected. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Kenya has become the latest African country to ban the use of polythene plastic bags, imposing stiff fines and even jail term for anyone found using, importing, or manufacturing the bags. Muhammad Yusuf has the story for VOA from Nairobi.
In one of the biggest garbage dumping sites in Nairobi, it was business as usual Monday. Loads of plastic bags full of garbage were brought in, a testament to their widespread use in the capital. But no more, says the government. A new law went into effect Monday, making the manufacture, sell and use of polythene plastic bags illegal. Offenders can get slapped with penalties up to a 4-year jail term and a $40,000 fine. The National Environment Management Authority, with the help of security agencies, has been going around Nairobi to urge retailers and manufacturers to heed the new ban. Geoffrey Wahungu is the Director General of NEMA. He's promoting the Take Back scheme, basically calling on consumers to bring their own cloth bags or baskets from home.
I hope soon we'll start seeing people who are carrying this recycled material or alternative bags which are eco-friendly. All this is creating much more employment than is being lost.
Two plastic bags importers unsuccessfully challenged the ban before the High Court Friday. Kenya produces plastic bags for local use and export in the region. The National Association of Manufacturers has argued the ban will cost more than 60,000 jobs and hurt more than 170 companies. NEMA gave 6 months' notice of the new ban, but it still appears to have taken many in Kenya by surprise. Some large retailers have already switched to paper, but small traders are feeling the pinch. Simon Jenga runs a grocery kiosk. He says he lost customers Monday. He says the ban pains me a lot because a customer wants to purchase vegetables, but he doesn't have a bag and I can't give him one. So they leave my kiosk without buying. The government has to bring back the plastic bags. My livelihood depends on it. Tanzania, Uganda, Malawi and Cameroon have announced similar bans on plastic bags, although the bans aren't widely enforced. Rwanda is the only African country so far to both declare a ban and push people to follow the law. Kenyan Environment Minister Judy Wahungu told Reuters news agency that manufacturers and importers will be the ones initially targeted for enforcement of the ban. Experts argue that polythene bags are bad for the environment and public health. The thin plastic bags have been blamed for polluting cities and shorelines and killing animals who eat them. NEMA says the single-use polythene bags never fully biodegrade, remaining in the environment as small or even microscopic particles, essentially forever. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. The South Sudan Army turned over the body of American freelance journalist Christopher Allen to U.S. Embassy officials in Juba today after he was shot dead by government forces on Saturday. Allen was embedded with rebel fighters near the South Sudan-Uganda border in Kaya. Government officials turned over the body of the 28-year-old journalist to embassy officials at the Juba Military Hospital. Denise Knapp, counsel at the U.S. Embassy, thanked the military for releasing Allen's body. Government spokesman Michael McQuay told VOA on Monday that the journalist was fighting alongside the rebels. SPLM in opposition deputy spokesman Colonel Lam Paul Gabriel told VOA that Allen was only photographing a battle between government and rebel forces. South Sudan military spokesman Brigadier General Lul Roy Kwong says Allen's body was not released until today because of ongoing investigations into what had happened on Saturday near the border. Dr. Peter Ajak Bullen, head of the SPLA Military Corps, says an autopsy he performed confirmed that Allen died from a large gunshot wound to the head. Thousands of Sudanese and South Sudanese are in the United States under what is called temporary protected status, a period of time of usually 1 to 2 years. They are allowed to stay in this country because they cannot safely return home due to either conflict, environmental disaster, or other unusual circumstances. Advocates for these immigrants fear the Trump administration may restrict or terminate the designation for people from Sudan and South Sudan when a decision is expected on or before September 3rd. At that time, the U.S. Attorney General can either extend, redesignate, or end the program for Sudanese and South Sudanese living in this country. Patrice Lawrence, who advocates for immigrants from the program DocuBlock, says if the program is not extended, many people will be stuck, not knowing what to do. A spokesperson for the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services said Homeland Security will thoroughly review conditions in both countries before that deadline. And finally, the Texas Attorney General says Hurricane Harvey is probably the biggest storm to ever hit Texas. 3 days after it hit the coast as a Category 4 hurricane, the storm continues its unrelenting rain, transforming many streets into rivers. Thousands of residents in the southern U.S. state are stranded in submerged homes, and at least 4 people have died so far. The National Weather Service calls the flooding unprecedented. South Sudanese native Tabitha Awur, who lives with her family in Houston, told this program that the floods forced her family and neighbors to stay inside. But when one of her neighbors went into labor during the hurricane, the entire community banded together and responded to make sure that the baby and the mother were safe. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Fi Sabab by Ras Corby.
Fi Sabab, the kulu haja al behasil fi dunya. Ah, fakun mala, matastaji. Makum original Ras Corby.
We've been listening to Ras Corby with the song Fi Sabab. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. would like to hear what you think about our show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also check us on our Facebook page, South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.